It is Friday, February the 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, UN-sponsored Syrian peace talks.
The United Nations basically showed its weakness, its inability to do these kinds of things. And to be a peaceful, unbiased broker is one thing, but to be negligent is something else.
Also ahead, dealing with the Zika virus, going high-tech at the Super Bowl, plus the passing of a superstar in the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Special UN envoy Staffan de Mistura, who pronounced the latest effort at Syrian peace talks officially underway in Geneva on Monday, suspended them on Wednesday, insisting it would be a temporary pause to last not more than 3 weeks.
From the first day, I've indicated that I'm not prepared to hold talks for the sake of talks, and the Secretary General has said the same. The UN cannot allow simply procedural matters to actually become more important than actually the result for the humanitarian situation of the Syrian people who have been waiting for us to deliver this time, not a conference, but something concrete for them. I've therefore taken this decision to bring a temporary pause. Temporary pause. This is not the end, and it's not the failure of the talk.
De Mistura insisted he's not disappointed or even frustrated, but determined and realistic. Saudi-backed opposition delegation known as the High Negotiations Committee says it will not return unless it sees positive steps on humanitarian issues, including an end to airstrikes on civilian targets. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells my colleague Victor Beatty, given the latest success, the talks, if they ever reconvene, must be guided by new principles and ground rules.
The Assad government clearly has used a pause that is provided by the impending peace negotiations to strengthen its position in Aleppo. And Russia has helped them in the process. Now, these kinds of things do happen. I mean, it's nothing very unusual. The unusual part that I see is that it happened so brazenly, and the United Nations didn't even know that it was happening. The United Nations basically showed its weakness, its inability to do these kinds of things. And to be a peaceful, unbiased broker is one thing, but to be negligent is something else. Now, another problem exists, and that is the United Nations operation had brought along two broad adversaries who control only one-third of the country. The two-thirds of the country is controlled by other agencies, other forces, which are not even represented in these peace negotiations. So to begin with, these peace negotiations were a pie in the sky. They were not going to work out because they didn't represent the majority of the participants. They represented a small minority, especially one of those minorities that was not interested at all, was only interested in strengthening its position. And it did. Now, from now on, any attempts at negotiation will start from the Assad government and the Russians being on a much stronger foundation than the opposition, which then would mean that it's the ISIS, the Daesh, that will tend to benefit. And if they benefit, the fear that I have is that the moderate elements, which are now considered as the faithful opposition, will leave this faithful opposition and go and join ISIS, which will be very damaging and disastrous.
How likely will the talks resume in 3 weeks?
Not at all. Even if they were to get together, it would be just a face-saving, and that's it. Look, there is no foundation. What are they going to get together to negotiate on? Now they're going to require, the opposition is going to require, go back to the old lines that existed before this action in Aleppo, which the Assad government will not be interested to do, and the Russians will not force them to do it. So under those circumstances, what can be the foundation to begin? If the opposition group were to come in to negotiate under changed circumstances, that will show their weakness, and that would mean that many of their own parties will tend to leave, and they'll join the ISIS. This is the time when I think other parties must take on and be more aggressive. It's necessary that the parties that are opposed to the Russian intervention must become much more active.
That is Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Well, world leaders meeting in London have pledged $10 billion in humanitarian relief as well as jobs and education to people fleeing that war in Syria. Optimism over the outcome of the conference, however, has been overshadowed by what Iqbar was just talking about, the fighting around the rebel-held city of Aleppo. Henry Ridgewell is following the story.
Arriving at the Syria Donors Conference Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry implored the world to act fast.
If people are reduced to eating grass and leaves and killing stray animals in order to survive on a day-to-day basis, that is something that should tear at the conscience of all civilized people, and we all have a responsibility to respond to it.
The response was better than many had hoped for. $10 billion were pledged for 2016 and a further $5 billion in the years up to 2020. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon hailed the achievement.
Never has the international community raised so much money on a single day for a single crisis.
The money will help provide millions with life-saving care and give refugees access to education and jobs. The Amar Foundation, an aid agency, provides schooling and healthcare across the region. Its chair, Emma Nicholson, welcomed the pledges, but said world leaders must keep their promises.
Last year, 35% of the pledges were forthcoming. And of course, there's always not just forthcoming expenditure, there's the handing over of the funding, and on top of that, there's the actual expenditure of the money. So at the very far end of the line, those children waiting for education in Syria and the region, they still are waiting.
Syria's neighbours pledged to open their economies to provide more jobs for refugees, aided by $40 billion in loans and the opening of European markets. The optimism in London was overshadowed by the breakdown of talks between Syria's warring parties in Geneva. A surge in fighting has extinguished any fading hopes of a ceasefire. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces, backed by Russian air support and Hezbollah fighters, have cut off the rebels' supply route into Aleppo. Turkey says around 70,000 refugees are fleeing toward its border. Moscow has accused Turkey of preparing for a ground incursion to prevent Aleppo from falling into government hands. There was no immediate response from Ankara. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And during the donor conference on Thursday, Secretary of State Kerry pledged nearly $1 billion in new U.S. aid for Syrian refugees. You can stay on top of what's happening in Syria as well as the international efforts to end that crisis at our website, voanews.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Health officials moving quickly now to raise awareness about the Zika virus, which is spreading rapidly in the Americas. World Health Organization says there could be up to 4 million cases this year. The virus was discovered originally in Uganda's Zika forest. That was back in 1947. But scientists say it's never been a major problem on the continent. There's speculation that the virus in the Americas may be a different strain, but further study is needed to confirm all of that. Among those following developments is Brian Greenwood. He is a professor of clinical medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And from London now, he speaks with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the threat posed by Zika.
Like all epidemics, it's really quite difficult to tell. For example, at the beginning of the Ebola epidemic or meningitis epidemic, really the experts find it difficult to predict how big that's going to be. But I think it's certainly WHO was right to take this very seriously and that there really is a threat from this. But one can never be certain.
Now, you say the WHO is taking this seriously. Yes. Is it taking it more seriously, for example, than the H1N1 flu risk or MERS or something like that?
I think so. And I think the Ebola episode probably played a part in that, because as I'm sure you realize, the WHO was criticized for being too slow in starting that. And that may really have had some influence that they didn't want to be caught out again. But it is difficult. If you call something really serious too soon, then you get blamed. And then if you don't do it too soon and it really does go into a big epidemic, then you get blamed again. But I think probably that this was wise to be cautious and really to take this pretty seriously.
So when you say take it seriously, what exactly does that mean? What can be done?
Well, I think part of it is to produce information so that people get properly informed and to know what the risk is, what they might do about it. And I think that's happening. There's been a lot in the press on that. Generally, it's been pretty well-informed press, and that definitely helps. Otherwise, one gets panics and people start having irrational ideas. So there are a few things that can be done. And I mean, if you like, I can go over those.
Absolutely.
Well, as I think most people will know, this is spread by a mosquito. It's one particular mosquito that tends to live around people's houses in flower pots and dirty water. Obvious thing that one can do is to try to control the mosquitoes breeding around the house, something that everybody can participate in. If you're living in an area where this is thought to be happening, avoid getting bitten by mosquitoes. These ones can bite pretty well at any time of the day. They tend to bite more in the evening and in the morning, but one needs to be aware that they can bite any time. And so taking precautions, sleeping under a bed net, wearing long sleeves and trousers. I mean, I gather it's sort of carnival happening in Brazil this week, and people are pretty worried there about lots of people wandering around without too many clothes on and things. So, I mean, there are simple things that one can do like that that reduce the risk, although they won't reduce it completely.
Has a link been definitely established between Zika and the birth defects?
Reading the general scientific literature, I haven't yet seen anything that absolutely proves that. And I think most of the responsible scientific journals in their editorials and things are saying it's probable, but it hasn't absolutely been proven yet. But to me, it seems pretty likely. But it is odd. I mean, odd, this hasn't been seen before for an infection that's been around for probably hundreds of thousands of years, why it should have just happened now. So we do have to have just a little bit of caution. And there are ways, epidemiological ways, that can actually help to strengthen the link. But it isn't easy. You know, it took a long time with smoking and things before it was really conclusively proven that that was causing cancer. I know groups are beginning to work on that, and I think we'll get some much stronger data fairly soon.
That is Brian Greenwood. He is a professor of clinical medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. And it's time now to check out what's trending on social media. In International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with the latest. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. It's about the propaganda balloons across the de facto inter-Korean border. That's been going on for a while, but what's different this time is that the balloons are flown from the north to the south.
Yeah, I see. You know, I haven't heard a lot about the balloons from the north. So what's Pyongyang's message in all of this?
Steve, the South Korean media reported the leaflets are calling South Korea a land of political filth and its leaders human trash. That's why it added cigarette butts in the balloons to stress the point.
So if I remember correctly, the inter-Korean tensions eased quite drastically with an agreement. It was last year. What was it, August, right?
That's correct. But it flared up again when the North conducted its fourth nuclear test last month. And since then, it's been all downhill. The South resumed its loudspeaker broadcast along the demilitarized zone. The contents are mainly South Korean pop music and criticism of the Kim Jong-un regime.
Well, I understand the criticism part, but what's with the pop music?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, and what's even more surprising is that the K-pop turned out to be more effective than the criticism when it comes to dampening the North Korean soldiers' morale. But if you counter propaganda with propaganda, then it's just tit for tat. But if you can prove that your country is not like your target country, where everything is censored and controlled by the state, then you can prove to be a little different. And that's exactly what we try to do here at VOA, too.
Absolutely fair and unbiased news. So what's the South Korean reaction to this?
Not very positive. I went on to Naver News to find out more, which is the country's most popular news aggregator. A lot of people are criticizing what they view as the government's weak response to the North. Some of the balloons that didn't detonate crashed onto the rooftops in cars in villages near the border and damaged them pretty badly. It's unclear how the South Korean government can help the affected homes. Some people even went on to say that the government should allow North Korean defectors to send propaganda leaflets to the North, which, by the way, is still illegal. The activist groups still send them, but they're technically not allowed to. And of course, as you can imagine, in English language media, there were plenty of the butt of the joke comments. Steve?
Many thanks to you, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA _IE. Well, we shift our attention now to sports, where on Sunday, American-style football will celebrate the 50th anniversary of its championship game, better known as the Super Bowl. Fans attending the very first Super Bowl back in 1967 likely could not even imagine how high-tech the experience will be this year in Santa Clara, California. International Business Times media and culture reporter Max Willen speaks with my colleague Jim Stevenson about what's special about the new Levi's Stadium.
Every time an NFL team looks to build a new stadium, they have this mandate to build a stadium that's bigger and shinier and more impressive than the ones that came before it. When the San Francisco 49ers, who built Levi's Stadium, which is where the game will be played, they thought that rather than focus on building more luxury boxes or building bigger, shinier, snazzier video monitors to show instant replay on, they wanted the thing that was going to make their stadium stand out be internet connectivity and cell phone capability. That's exactly what they've done. Levi's Stadium has more Wi-Fi capacity of any other NFL stadium and really any other stadium in the United States. All that extra bandwidth has really made it possible for them to play around with the kinds of experiences that you have while you're at the stadium. Specifically, in this case, we're talking about an app that the people that are attending the game can use. And the app, really, if you're using it to its fullest, really can kind of change the way that people think about attending an NFL game. You can order a drink that will be brought right to your seat. You can order merch that you can pick up on your way out of the stadium. You can watch instant replay after every single play. You can even watch, during the stoppages, you can watch the Super Bowl commercials that everyone talks about so much while you're sitting there in your seat.
That's a big deal, because I've been to a few Super Bowls, and I'll tell you, I had to videotape them and go back and watch because I had no clue what was going on during the telecast, and I knew everybody was going to be talking about the commercials, of course. I've also been in stadiums where it's very difficult just to make a phone call. This is a big deal.
It's a huge deal. In 2014, when the Super Bowl was held at MetLife Stadium outside of New York City, more than 2.5 terabytes of cellular data passed through the stadium on Super Bowl Sunday. That's a ton of data, obviously, but there are projections that this year at Levi's Stadium, they're talking about a number north of 16 terabytes. It's just an incredible amount of data that they're going to have to provide.
These stadiums really are not used a lot during the year. There's a limited amount of time that they have with all the people in to make the most of those people being there in terms of selling beverages and merchandise and that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. You think of NFL stadiums as being these impressive, potentially very useful, money-generating fixtures in a landscape, but they're actually almost the opposite. I mean, Levi's Stadium, for example, in 2015, it only played host to 20 events, and 10 of those were NFL games. That's 8 regular season and 2 preseason. And it's just very difficult to find use for a building that holds 60, 70, 80, 90,000 people. And because they're so expensive, you know, often costing north of $1 billion or even $2 billion, it's really very important for the owners to figure out not only how to maximize on the people that do walk through the turnstiles, but also just to figure out what they can do to make sure that those people want to come back.
International Business Times media and culture reporter Max Willens, he was speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
This is Bisbee.
Being deaf has not stopped Mara Landinas from opening up her own business. In sign language, she says,
many of my friends love my clothes, they love my shoes, and it really hit me that maybe I should become a fashion designer instead. So that's when I decided.
At her New York store, Mara uses sign language to communicate with customers. But so does Russ Stein, a restaurant owner. Using sign language, he says, it's not as complicated as one might think.
Just imagine yourself in another country, for example. How do you communicate? You know, you use gestures, you point.
There's about a million deaf people in the U.S., 70 million worldwide. Tom Baldridge of Gallaudet University says technology is playing a big role for the disabled.
Social media and email have made face-to-face oral communication less necessary in interacting with deaf people.
For Russ and Mara, they believe more of the hearing community are opening their ears to the deaf. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Rapper Andre 3000 of Outkast surprised a fan with a once-in-a-lifetime Uber ride recently. International Edition's David Byrd speaks now with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about how all that happened.
So this is a really fun story. So he shows up in L.A. He is there to help put the finishing touches on Kanye West's new album, which is this highly anticipated album Kanye calls the best album of life. So Andre 3000 is there to go to the studio, and for whatever reason, Kanye doesn't send Andre a car. So he instead calls Uber. He meant to call Uber, and Uber is a car-sharing service, and normally you get your own car. It's like a single-passenger service, but
right.
There
somebody,
is...
the driver gets paid to pick you up.
Right, and it's just you. Well, they have this thing called Uber Pool, which allows you to carpool with other people who are going in your general direction. So Uber comes and picks him up, and there is a young lady who he is already in the car, and Andre, being the good sport that he is, says, all right, fine, I'll get in the car with this woman. And they drive toward the studio, and they hit it off. It turns out that he and this young lady lived in the same building at one time, and he said to her, well, listen, I'm on my way over here to the studio. Would you like to come with me? So she said, well, okay, why not? And so she pulls up to the studio, gets out, goes into the recording booth, and there's P. Diddy, Puffy, there's Kanye West, there's French Montana, 2 Chainz, and Kid Cudi, some of the biggest names in hip-hop, recording what is going to be, according to Kanye West, the biggest album of life. I mean, and now I know that there are probably young people all over the country hoping that the next time they get into an Uber, they'll get in with some famous hip-hop star and end up in the studio, maybe on a track.
If I called Uber, it'd be some guy who'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to Fairfax. or one of those types of like, why are you, what, you want to share my car?
Right.
Get out. Keep driving. now, on a slightly different note, Uber has changed their app thing,
mm-hmm.
where it looks different now, and this young lady got to rub shoulders with some of the princes of hip hop.
Sure.
And, Uber could almost use that for an ad.
Oh,
absolutely. Have Andre 3000 roll up in a car, go, hi.
Oh, absolutely. I don't doubt it. I looked for some statistics before I came in to see if Uber experienced a peak or a rise in usage. I didn't find anything. I'm going to keep looking for it. I'll post it up on Facebook or Twitter or something. But I have no doubt there are more people using Uber now than before. In fact, I downloaded the Uber app on my phone just in case.
Just in case I'm headed up U Street and somebody says, hey, we're going to the 9:30 Club.
No. Just in case.
Well, what do you think? Do you think chance encounters like this are really chance? What would you do if a famous hip-hop star suddenly wanted to share a ride with you? Let us know. Let Shauna know. You can hit her up on Twitter. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send her a tweet at VOA_music. And you can also log on to our website. That's voanews.com.
And many thanks to you, Dave, and to Shauna. Excellent story. Amazing. Listen, this is the way it's turned out this week. Another sad week in the world of music. Maurice White co-founded the funk soul band Earth and Wind and Fire. Amazing band, we all know. Died after a long battle with Parkinson's. He was 74. Many have died recently. I mean, we were just talking about it earlier. After serving as a session drummer for Chess Records and playing with the Ramsey Lewis Trio, White then founded Earth, Wind, and Fire in 1969 in Chicago. He was the group's leader. He shared lead vocal duties with Philip Bailey, co-wrote and produced many of the band's hits, including Shining Star, Big Song, Sing a Song, Boogie, Wonderland, and this one, September. One of those songs you can't sit still when you're listening to it. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always great having you around. Glad you came to be with us today. Want to remind you the top world news is straight ahead. And for our director Tracy Carter and our engineer Jonah Cummings, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday. Now some more of Maurice White and Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the Boko Haram terrorist attacks on January 29th and 30th in northeast Nigeria. On January 30th, in the village of Dolori, the terrorist bombed a market, attacked a village, and firebombed huts. Boko Haram militants set fire to as many as 300 homes in the village, burning alive some people who were inside, including children. According to Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency, at least 65 people were killed and 136 injured. Boko Haram, which in March 2015 pledged its allegiance to the Islamic State, has been attacking northern Nigeria for years. According to press reports, Boko Haram's insurgency has killed 20,000 people in the last 6 years and driven at least 2.3 million from their homes. Boko Haram continues to commit vicious attacks against the innocent, including children. This terrorist organization repeatedly has shown no regard for human life. We extend our deepest condolences to the families of the latest victims of Boko Haram. The United States will continue to support those affected by Boko Haram's violence through ongoing humanitarian aid and support services. In response to the threat posed by Boko Haram, President Barack Obama announced in October 2015 that the United States would send 300 U.S. troops, along with surveillance drones, to Cameroon to bolster a West African effort to counter the militant Islamist group. U.S. troops were tasked with conducting airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance operations in the region. In a statement issued on February 2nd, State Department spokesperson John Kirby said the United States remains committed to supporting Nigeria and its Lake Chad Basin partners in the fight against terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.